Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to our show. In this podcast, we will be interviewing four different individuals. They are all from Edafia, one of the leading cybersecurity firms in Arkansas, actually. And Jeremy, why don't you go ahead and get started, please, with the Edafia history, and then everybody can kind of introduce themselves. How is that done?
I think that'll be a good start. First of all, thank you for the opportunity to have a really good Friday afternoon chat with some friends about some things that we're really interested in. So just to give you guys a little bit of history and background, Edafia's been in business about 20 years or so. Our roots and our DNA really come out of, you know, IT services and primarily the healthcare industry, but we service, you know, pretty much all the different verticals around. We have some pretty healthy practices around healthcare, cybersecurity, IT services, networking services, all that kind of stuff. You know, we grew out of an accounting firm, which I think I mentioned. We've got offices in both Central and Northwest Arkansas. And we've got associates kind of across the Mid-South region. So, you know, we've really kind of embraced the virtual workspace.
Okay, excellent. Now, before we get into the meat of our show, could everybody kind of give an introduction to themselves?
Sure. I'll start, Jeremy, and then if you want to introduce yourself and give a little bit more information about your background. Good morning, everybody. My name is Valerie Mooring. I'm the healthcare and cybersecurity team lead at Edafia Technology Partners. This is actually the month I celebrate my four-year anniversary with the company, so super excited to be here working at Edafia, leading a team of just really phenomenal healthcare consultants and cybersecurity consultants. Before I came to Edafia, I worked at a nonprofit called Arkansas Foundation for Medical Care, and there we were the boots on the ground, helping providers and hospitals implement electronic medical records and also helping them think about, you know, the security risk assessments and the security risk analysis that was involved as part of that process. Our team helps our clients and add value to our clients by helping them run and protect their business, navigate cybersecurity issues, help them with healthcare delivery, policy improvements, and also we have services around quality payment programs for our clients as well. Above all, really my passion is to bring quality-based, metric-driven, patient-centric, secure, and affordable healthcare to our region. So that's just a little bit about me. Thanks again for having us. Jeremy?
Yeah, thank you. So as Valerie said, you know, my name is Jeremy. I operate as Edafia's information security officer. I've been in the cybersecurity world for a while. I've been in IT for probably about 20 years-ish. I've spent quite a bit of time in MSP environments. So I've done a lot of virtual CISO work, virtual CIO work for organizations across the state. I hold a number of designations, but really kind of what I kind of claim is my specialty is this ability to translate between technology and what I entertainingly call execu-speak, right? So it's really this understanding and aligning business with technology in the cybersecurity front. So
excellent.
In conjunction. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm fine.
Okay. Kinsey?
My name is Kinsey Tickle, and I have been with Edafia for 3 years, and I serve as a healthcare compliance and cybersecurity consultant. My background is primarily in healthcare, working for one of the largest health insurance payers in Arkansas. And then upon coming to Edafia, I started in the cybersecurity space, working on the healthcare and cybersecurity team, working primarily with security awareness program that we offer.
Okay. Keith, can you please go ahead?
And my name is Keith Crawford. I am a senior cybersecurity consultant with Adafio. Been with Adafio almost 3 years now. I've been in the IT consulting and services realm for 20 years. Started in this industry from the network engineering side, and back when security in this market was just firewalls and antivirus and VLANs. And I've always been a security hobbyist, really dug deeper into the network infrastructure security side for quite some time, and then over the years transitioned into a full-time cybersecurity role. And I do advisory and consulting, serve as an advisory CISO for clients, and really want to have clients catch a vision for how to be more successful and not just see security and compliance as a necessary evil or something that they have to do, but to understand how it can really add rigor and maturity to help an organization thrive if they do this in a sustainable manner.
Okay, excellent. Thank you for all of your background. It's definitely a deep and rich cybersecurity background there. Now let's go ahead and get started with the meat of our show. First question is, you know, with the remote workforce and with COVID-19 now, almost in the second year now, year and a half now, data privacy has become one of the big hot topic buttons. We heard the GDPR and the CCPA, but HIPAA is something that's still not as well talked about. Do healthcare providers really have a good understanding of what's expected by HIPAA? And are there any areas you see they're not getting enough attention in that?
So I will say from my experience, I have seen where providers and covered entities really do have a general understanding of HIPAA more from a privacy perspective. I think where maybe some of the attention is not seen as much is in really the impact that HIPAA violation or security breach really is going to have on the organization. And so I think not realizing how real the threats are is where I'm seeing some of the maybe lack of recognition of HIPAA and its role in the organization. And so with that, I see that some areas that probably need most covered entities need some more focus on is going to be policy governance. So not just in privacy, but also on, and more specifically in the security rule and the requirements for having your security policies, and not just having the policy, but also having that governance around the policy where it's continually reviewed and it's not just sitting on the shelf. And then the other piece is the risk management. And with the security risk management, whenever areas are identified that need to be focused on, really taking that time to develop a risk management plan and not only identify the risk, but make that plan for how that risk is going to be mitigated and remediated.
Yeah, excellent.
Yeah, I would say add to that too. You know, I mean, over the last 10, 15 years, healthcare organizations are getting, you know, a better understanding of HIPAA and especially how that relates, you know, to how they're taking care of their patients or maybe how a business associate needs to take care of the covered entity's data. So they're definitely getting a better understanding. I feel like organizations are now really wanting to move the needle and getting away from this checkbox mentality that we really saw in the beginning is, you know, we would hear organizations maybe say, well, what's the minimum that I just need to do to check this box? And so, you know, at Adafio, we're really passionate about, you know, we don't want to have checkbox mentality. We want our consulting to, again, really add value and enrich our clients' day-to-day business and taking care of their patients, really enable them to do that in a safer, more secure way.
That really ties into, you know, kind of what Kinsey was talking about with our policy focus is, you know, we want that policy to be living and informing day-to-day practices. You know, that can't be something that was done 4 years ago and somebody thinks it's in a folder somewhere. You know, it needs to be appropriate for the organization. It's got to be understood by the organization, you know, track to make sure that we're catching updated changes, that we're seeing where there might be gaps of following our policies, and really using that as a foundation to define the program on an ongoing basis and not just a piece of paper that's not looked at very often.
You know, you mentioned, Robbie, COVID and just, you know, how the workforce moved home. And an example of that, and we talked about this quite a bit last year, especially in the summer, we hosted and worked on several different webinars where, you know, we produced one-pagers and talked about, you know, how to ensure that those devices that are connecting to the network, you know, how were organizations securing that? And then also, you know, let's talk about, you know, those home routers and how to make sure those are a little bit more secured up and things like that. So it's definitely something that, again, is building and changing all the time. And we're working to, you know, evolve that communication and what we're talking about to our clients.
Sure. Well, I've been reading about and I've been writing some blog postings how the healthcare industry, you know, how some of these organizations and providers are really, really being hammered by, you know, very sophisticated ransomware attacks. Not so much more of paying up the ransom, it's not more of like extortion. Like, if you don't pay me, we'll release this information, you know, the PII data sets of your patients down on the dark web and sell them. Have you guys done any work on that, protecting, I mean, like with the ransomware? Is that something you want to talk about later in the podcast?
Yeah, we can go ahead and touch on it for sure. It's obviously a major priority on a preventative proactive side. Thankfully, we have not seen a dramatic increase in actual events among the organizations that we work with, but we do see those threats continuing to increase and evolve, and we really want that to be a multiple approach, right? We can't just look at email security. We can't just look at endpoint security. You've got to look at the technical aspects and build resilience within that organization to understand how to detect those things, how to prevent them. And then if something does happen, having a playbook so that you know what steps to take, you know, to reduce the impact of that. You know, downtime from ransomware is still one of the most significant cost risk out there. I think the last report I saw was the average downtime based in the Q4 report was 21 days for a ransomware event. And so everything that you can do to respond quickly and appropriately, we want to help our organizations prevent but also prepare.
Okay, excellent. Now, how does Adafio help healthcare providers? So, for example, suppose I'm a doctor and I have a practice with other doctors in there. Walk me through the process of how I actually approach you and what you do for me from the beginning to the end. Or what's an ongoing partnership? What does that look like?
Valerie, y'all want to kind of start with that assessment piece?
Yeah, I was going to say that really a lot of the time we do start with a project-based security risk assessment. And something I've been passionate about since I've been at Adafio is that, you know, we want to make sure that we're constantly improving that process. We want to make sure that we're covering, you know, physical, technical, and administrative safeguard sections of the security rule. So it's really doing, you know, this assessment, this point in time assessment that then organizations can take and build out on, you know, risk registers and compliance consulting and things like that we want to talk about later in the podcast. But really, you can't, you know, develop a roadmap and some of the things that Keith has mentioned already until you kind of know where you're at. So we really do like to start, you know, with this assessment. It's really looking at all these different areas that are hitting the healthcare organizations and really coming in and partnering with them after we've looked at a number of different areas that we do cover in the security risk assessments.
To borrow a term from the healthcare industry, you know, we kind of look at having a prescription without a diagnosis is malpractice. And we really want to do a very comprehensive assessment. A lot of organizations aren't doing regular assessments or aren't doing them as comprehensively in order to meet those HIPAA compliance expectations. So we really want to start with getting that picture of the organization. And then we can define where there are risk in security, risk in compliance, gaps in documentation to talk about the next steps.
Okay. Go ahead. Well, you know, I was just going to add to that. One of the things that we pretty consistently find in the services is this need for education and awareness about what's going on, right? There's a lot of maturation that we find is kind of a natural outcome and result of assessments. So part of the services offerings that we have, part of what just makes organizations successful is this idea of this continuing education.
Go ahead, please.
We do offer training, and that's actually what I was going to say is, as we do just some initial phishing testing as part of, again, our SRA, our security risk assessment project. So from that, if, you know, organizations have never phished their users or, you know, looked out on the dark web to see if they have compromised accounts, for example, then that's something that they get a little taste of that in an assessment so they can see, you know, there are some potential risks or vulnerabilities out there. We do see, you know, other organizations that may do one or the other. You know, they may do a vulnerability scan or, you know, a physical walkthrough, you know, or phishing testing, but they don't package it all together. So, again, we do try to hit on all those topics. And then from that, we build and offer security awareness programs that actually our cybersecurity consultants and our analysts do a phenomenal job of delivering those reports and communicating what the reports mean to the clients. That's another area that I feel like, Adafio, we really set ourselves apart because we do take it a step above, you know, just providing reports but not having a really good conversation about what reports mean. That's another thing that I'm really passionate about because there is, you know, there's tech speak and then there's healthcare speak and then somewhere in the middle, you know, we meet so that we understand all these different acronyms and terms and really at the end of the day, we just want to equip our clients and help them to protect the data.
Okay. I was just going to say, we want our clients to see assessments as a starting point and not an end point. You know, if you do an assessment and then you do nothing with it, you're not really getting the benefit. And that's where we really want to then lean into, you know, training. There may be ongoing, you know, scanning for vulnerabilities, risk management, compliance consulting, policy development. In a variety of ways based on where we identified those gaps that we want to help show them how to manage towards that because you don't want an assessment year over year identifying those same gaps. And even if you are making progress in areas, you've got to be able to have that reflected in your documentation on both the security risk management and compliance side so you can demonstrate that work in case you're ever audited.
Okay. Now, do you follow, now does HIPAA have like a risk assessment framework that you use to kind of use as a checkpoint list, or do you use anything from the NIST frameworks as a starting point for your assessments?
Yeah, so I've written a couple of articles about, you know, HIPAA-compliant risk assessments. You know, there's a lot of misconception that a risk assessment is all you need to do, right, in order to be compliant. And that's really not the case. I'd say that there's quite a bit of guidance and suggestion in the HIPAA language that tells you what you need to do. So from that perspective, I guess you could kind of call it a bit of a framework. There's a lot of ONC and others that have put out, you know, guidance and recommendations, and all of that it's maturing quite a bit. Yes, we do follow NIST and ISO and HIPAA and some other frameworks as part of the assessment process, if that makes sense. So it's really pulling from a NIST-based framework and customizing it as appropriate for our clients.
Yeah, so there's, as part of HIPAA will tell you, it does state as part of the security risk assessment what things you need to be assessing. So it does state what must be included in your SRA, and so we do use that as the guideline to ensure HIPAA compliance, but to from, I guess, more of a technical standpoint, security framework, we do assess also against the NIST framework, because that is the framework that HIPAA references. So we do use multiple frameworks. So.
Okay. Now, security and compliance are two terms that are kind of used interchangeably. I think there is a stark difference between the two. What are your thoughts on that? How are they synonymous with each other, and how are they different?
Care.
Go ahead, Keith.
I was going to say, in healthcare, these have to be have an enormous amount of synergy between them. You know, security and compliance, they do have different charters. You know, one's about protecting an organization's you know, revenue and their data and their production. And compliance is about really being able to demonstrate that work to a third party, and in this case, you know, the HIPAA expectations and ONC and OCR. And, you know, compliance does not equal security, but it does drive that due diligence, right? There is this expectation around what you should be doing and what documentation you should be having, those sort of elements. And a good security practice, it should be, you know, I constantly say it should be demonstrable, right? It's kind of like doing your math homework. If you get the right answer, that's great. But then the teacher says you got to show your work. A good security program should be able to show your work as part of that. So they are different. They do have different charters, but there's a huge amount of overlap. And that's really why we have the HIPAA compliance and healthcare, you know, experts on this team, because sometimes as a security person, I will get focused on the security side, and I have to have, you know, Kinsey or Valerie say, hey, wait a minute, we've got to document that, or, you know, we've got to think about this particular risk that's coming out of that compliance framework.
Okay. Okay. Now, what do you see on the ground in terms of OCR investigations and data breaches?
So, in terms of the OCR investigations and data breaches, I mean, first and foremost, I think it's important for covered entities to realize that OCR audits do happen. So, if you have a security breach, specifically if it affects more than 500 individuals, then you can expect that you are going to be hearing from OCR. There will be an investigation and there will be an audit. And those are very time consuming, and there's tons of documentation that has to be collected. You know, there's a letter that you'll receive from the OCR asking, you know, 20 questions about, you know, what happened with the breach and what are you doing? So what security protocols did you already have in place? Where are those risks that were there that allowed the breach to occur, and what are you doing to correct it? So it's very time consuming to go through an investigation and audit.
Well,
go ahead.
going to add, this is Valerie, that, you know, that's one of the other reasons why we're really passionate. So between this and just reading, you know, the OCR, what they call deemed the wall of shame, and reading some of the investigation efforts and fines and penalties or remediation plans, you know, we see repeat year after year things coming up like, you know, unencrypted laptops were stolen or security risk assessments that either were not performed or they were performed, but they did not action and they did not have any documentation of such that they remediated the risk. So, again, this is another reason that we're real passionate about talking to our clients and helping our clients with the documentation that shows those remediation efforts. You know, the most difficult thing about all of this is tying it all together and getting it organized and put in a place that you can put your hands on quickly. So there are time frames when these types of events pop up, and they, of course, expect you to get that documentation of them very quickly. And so if you've got it in email, you know, out on a shared drive, or maybe the person that was responsible for this for the organization left 2 years ago and, you know, you have no idea where it's at, it's lost. So it's all about having, you know, the collective documentation in one place protected with, you know, a personnel backup. You know, there's technical backups, but there's administrative backups that need to be, you know, placed around this type of documentation. And that's, it really is difficult to keep it all organized.
And as part of that, you know, knowing what the OCR is going to look for. So talking about the documentation, one thing that we do use to help guide as we go through compliance and security consulting with our clients is the OCR audit checklist. So, you know, it lists out everything that an OCR auditor may request through the process from every CFR that requires a policy. So we use that to help guide our consulting and documentation efforts.
Thank you.
Well, and, you know, one of the things that Kinsey and, you know, this healthcare team does is, you know, they're reading these corrective actions plans. They're reading all the findings. They're looking at OCR enforcement guidance. To really stay in tune with what is OCR prioritizing, how are they writing their findings. And then one of the aspects I see commonly emphasized is people talk about the fines. And I've had lawyers, you know, basically tell a client, well, don't worry about that. Only a very small percentage of clients ever get fines. You know, I want clients and organizations to know that, you know, corrective action plans are no fun. You know, a corrective action plan, even if you don't get a finding, get a fine from OCR, if they say, hey, these things need to be addressed, that's a corrective action plan. And then they're going to lay out a time frame, you know, 12, 18, 24 months where you should, you're going to lay out how you're going to address the things that you were not doing. You know, you don't get corrective action plans and fines because you had a breach. You get corrective action plans and fines because you weren't doing what HIPAA says you should be doing. And so a lot of organizations that haven't prioritized things like policies and risk management and training and documentation, suddenly not only are you going to have to prioritize that, you're going to have to report on it and, you know, and do many of those things quickly. And that can get, you know, those are very expensive as well. So fines are not the only downside of having an OCR finding against you. Corrective action plans can really be a significant change and cost to the organization.
Now, are the fines just as steep as a GDPR? Because I know the GDPR can be 4% of gross revenue, and with the CCPA, it's like $750 per every PII data set that's been heisted. Are the HIPAA fines just as bad too, or where do they fall in the ballpark?
Kinsey, I'm going to let you speak to kind of where the fine ranges fall. The first thing I would say is GDPR fines are mostly theoretical in practice over the last couple of years. I know they're saying that's beginning to change, but you know, the vast majority seems that they're, you know, that's not a case. OCR fines are not theoretical; they're published on a website mm-hmm. that you can go see. So they are real and they happen. And then I'll let Valerie and Kinsey kind of talk about where the enforcement guidance has kind of put some of those ranges.
Yeah, so I will say that the penalties and fines can range. You know, you see penalties as high as, you know, several million, $2-3 million, and then others where, you know, you're in a couple hundred thousand dollar range, which, you know, regardless of the organization, I think, you know, even a small organization with a several hundred thousand dollar fine, that's very impactful for the bottom line. And those ranges really depend on, you know, there's four tiers of the penalty. So, you know, you have the penalty that starts out where, you know, you have a risk and maybe you weren't aware of it and you corrected it, all the way up to the repeatable risks. So you have a risk that has not been corrected, that's been identified, and has continued to occur. And that's one reason why we are so adamant and passionate about working with organizations to help correct those risks, because if they are not addressed, you know, year over year, those penalties and fines are detrimental to the organization.
They're not the only cost here. You know, if you experience a significant incident and a data breach, you know, even without you know, an OCR fine, which, you know, you will get varying opinions on the possibilities of those, data breach costs are rising. I don't know that I would say they're skyrocketing. They've been high for quite some time. But, you know, the average cost of a data breach in the healthcare industry last year is $7.13 billion. Now, that has loss of production numbers and other things in it, but I would say it's very common to see hard costs, forensics and legals and notifications, run, you know, $1.5 million, $2.5 million. And a lot of organizations have not prepared for that cost. You know, they bought a cyber insurance policy 3 years ago that gives them $1 million worth of coverage, and they don't have that tied to their organization's growth or patient size, patient churn, you know, all the different aspects that are going to impact those potential costs. So data breach costs, even without fines, are a significant number these days.
Okay. Now, lately with the COVID-19 vaccines coming out from Pfizer, J&J, and Moderna, there's been a lot of talk about supply chain risk, and just from the standpoint of cybersecurity. What types of things should healthcare providers be thinking about as it comes to their vendors and software manufacturers? This is where I would say where third-party risks come into play as well, too, as there's so many people involved in this chain, like the logistics distribution, those entities that provide the raw materials and making the vaccines. Can you go over this and give some answers, please?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, again, one thing that we're really working with a lot of our clients on, and we do talk to them about, and it is surprising to see that a lot of organizations don't have the business associate agreements in place that actually protect the covered entities. So first and foremost, it's really just, you know, reviewing all of your vendors, defining and understanding and knowing what they're doing for you, and making sure that, you know, you have signed business associate agreements with those that are helping you take care of your patients. The other interesting thing is, back on that earlier question and a point to that is, you know, a lot of business associates, sometimes they're not even aware or understand that, you know, it's not just, you know, the hospitals and the clinics, you know, that could be subject to these fines and penalties. But again, these business associates have potential fines and penalties if they're not taking care of the data that they're responsible for, the protected health information. So that business associate agreement is what lays those, you know, protections out and talks about what the requirements are of the business associates.
Yeah, and with the business associate agreements for covered entities, there I've seen several penalties that covered entities have incurred because of the lack of a business associate agreement. So that is definitely one point in which we're seeing penalties and fines. So it's critical for, you know, healthcare providers to have those business associate agreements and also have a process for, as Valerie talked about, you know, auditing, making sure that you have those for each of your applicable business associates. And then on top of that, I'm holding them accountable for their security protocols and ensuring that they are accessing the healthcare provider's PHI securely as it is laid out in the business associate agreement.
In business associate agreements are part of that contractual initiation process. And supply chain risk management has to start at the very beginning with that contract, making sure that if you have things that you need them to do, that that's getting defined, you know, defining review expectations, control expectations. But I would even say, you know, looking at who's responsible for incident response for a particular system. If you're setting up a workstation from a vendor that that vendor owns inside your environment, if someone finds a threat, is that your responsibility or is theirs? You don't want to have that conversation once you find the threat. You want those items clearly defined in that contract of whose responsibility is it to monitor or to respond or you know, take the financial, you know, liability around that. So whether you're looking at incident response or you're looking at cloud systems, you really have to have that process formalized and regularly followed when you're out there looking at, you know, new vendors, new software packages, new cloud packages.
The one thing I'd add to this conversation is kind of this idea of what we're part of what we're talking about here is this idea of secure by design. This idea that, you know, you consider and you design your service offerings and your delivery and your organization with security in mind on the front end, like Keith was talking about. You know, when you do that, you end up saving yourself costs, you end up saving yourself heartache, you end up saving yourself a lot of inefficiencies, not only in, you know, all of these, you know, fines and inefficiencies that you end up with, but you really end up being able to differentiate yourself.
Well, and that secure design, you know, to pivot just slightly to talk about kind of SolarWinds, you know, there's a lot of organizations, I shouldn't say there's a lot, there's some organizations saying, you know, in response to SolarWinds, you need to throw paperwork, if you will, at your supply chain risk management process and do fourth party risk management and more questionnaires, those sorts of things. So yes, the due diligence of your supply chain risk management and contracts and reviewing those controls are important, but that likely would not have stopped SolarWinds. You know, SolarWinds is a situation where you had to have significant monitoring to even have an opportunity to catch this. But if you had this in your organization, if it was designed with least privilege, if you were limiting traffic on those sorts of things, then you were greatly limiting the impact that an event thing can then have. So it really takes both sides of the house of having a good process for risk management and then using secure design principles to narrow the scope of access and connectivity to only what's appropriate, making sure that you're restricting those things and monitoring them appropriately.
Okay, now have any of you come across any exclusive threats you've seen to the supply chain as it relates to the COVID-19 vaccine? Have you resolved any issues for clients in that regard yet?
Kenzie, I'm thinking most of what we've seen related to COVID is really through the fishing side.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah, that's just what I was going to say, too. That's really the only impact there I saw as well. So just an increased, number of phishing emails and people doing the phishing and the text messages. So, yeah, it was definitely something that they were hitting hard and heavy on. And that's another good reason why, you want a good security with security awareness program. Yes. So that you can customize, those particular types of campaigns and educate users early. So you can build it into that security awareness program. And that's something that we do at Adolfio.
Okay. Excellent.
Overall, we were very resilient in our response regarding staffing, and we saw some technology slowdowns and, purchasing new equipment and those sorts of things. But so we had some things to work through, but I don't think we saw anything that was a critical hampering, to any of our clients regarding supply chain and just the risk result regarding what we saw with the COVID-19 and the economic impact payments, really fired up the social engineering side of the threat landscape.
Absolutely. And, there was a bit of a force multiplier with this rapid transition to the remote workforce, right? So it really kind of changed the working environment, which didn't help matters too awful much. I'm sorry, you were going to say something, Valerie?
I was just going to say it's interesting because it had a positive effect with a lot of organizations on their physical security. So they locked down, entrances to different doors and only had patients and visitors coming in one door.
Okay. No.
That's a really neat side effect I hadn't thought about.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I was just saying that's neat. I hadn't even thought about that aspect of it. So,
okay. What are the top four or five things that every healthcare organization should prioritize in terms of security and compliance? I think you've listed multi-factor authentication. That would fall in the world of the Zero Trust framework. Cybersecurity insurance. I just wrote a book manuscript on cybersecurity insurance. That's a very complex field, and I think it's even harder to understand than medical insurance. So what are your thoughts on all this?
Well, I'll talk about the insurance piece, and then I'll let Jeremy kind of talk more about, identity management and multi-factor. So cyber insurance is very much a zebra. It's very unique compared to different insurance products out there. It is the only non-regulated insurance product in the United States, so it's not like property or casualty or liability insurance where it has to have certain things in. So because it's unregulated, you can get a wide variety of differences between different carriers' insurance packages. So your basic recommendations is, one, we recommend talking to someone that specializes in cyber insurance. Your business insurance broker, if they don't know cyber insurance in depth, ask them if they have someone else inside the organization that does, or you might have to look elsewhere. And by the way, that applies to legal as well. You want people that know this space very in depth. Secondly, you've got to be reading these policies. There are exceptions. There are exclusions. You need to know what that looks like. It needs to be documented as part of your incident response plan, when you're going to call, how you contact them. And then reviewing those coverages on an annual basis. So you should be reshopping your insurance every single year, both from a price standpoint, but also because the language is changing, honestly, every year from most providers. I know one provider out there that has not updated their language in 3 years, and every single other one that I've seen, those policies are being updated on an annual basis. So know where your coverages are, know how those coverages apply. But we really see cyber insurance as a enablement factor. When you're faced with dealing with a data breach, knowing that you have some coverage there can really help you make excellent decisions around going to get good forensics, about having support through notification processes, and not having to just look at the dollar signs associated with those data breach costs.
Yes, so to pick up on the MFA thread, I struggle with how to begin talking about multi-factor authentication and how to really kind of contextualize it. I think it may be the closest thing to, you know, a good solution that we found about the identity protection, right? As far as simple goes, right? It's a great entry point into understanding this concept and this idea of identity providers, and this idea of, you know, as you were talking about, or as you mentioned earlier, zero trust approach, right? So when I say it's probably the best, simplest thing, one of the reasons that drives that opinion is, you know, we've seen statistics that say things like MFA blocks 99% of account compromise attacks, right? It is this element, this thing that you can do that allows you a second point of verification and authorization that I am who I say that I am. So let me into the things that I'm trying to get into, right? It's a really broad field. Is there anything in particular or specific that you were curious about MFA?
Pardon me?
Oh, I was just asking, you know, it's kind of a broad topic. I was curious if you were, if you had anything in particular you wanted to.
Well, I think multi-factor authentication is a must. The thing is, I've written numerous articles on 2FA, MFA, and the ZTF, the Zero Trust Framework. I think 2FA is outdated. The cyber attacker can break through two lines of defenses very easily. I think multi-factor authentication is needed. You need to segment your networks into various subnets. Each micro-segment needs to have its own layer of security. And in that regard, I think biometrics is a very good thing to use, like iris recognition or fingerprint recognition, and for that matter, even facial recognition, you know, though there's some questionable doubts about that. Zero Trust Framework, that's like, I think, the ultimate of all identity access management frameworks. I think it's a bit extreme, and I tell people that's where you basically absolutely do not trust anybody, even your employee who's been around with you for the longest time. You can't trust anybody with anything, both internal and external environment. It's a bit harsh, it's a bit extreme, but you know what? I've been reading about it, and companies that have actually instituted that framework, they're actually seeing some positive results with that. But the thing is, I've had people ask me, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
I've had even people ask me, is MFA the same thing as perimeter security? And it's not the same thing. Perimeter security, I view that just like one line of security, you know, kind of like a circumference around your company. Whereas the multi-factor, as I said before, you're kind of bringing in different subnets, and each one is having its own layer. And the way I tell people about this, like if I have clients I'm writing an article for, I just tell them, look, the reason you want that is the statistical odds of a cyber attacker breaking through many lines of defense versus just one or two becomes statistically much lower before they can hit those prize jewels or crown jewels, which in this case in the healthcare industry would be the PII data sets of patients.
Yeah, I think you said that really well, kind of this idea of, you know, you've got to prove to me who you are, when you are, and what you are before I let you get to my data. I love this idea that you're laying out there that, you know, there's a lot of thought and theory behind the idea of moving away from trusting people and things and placing your controls there and getting to a data-centric perspective, right? I'm protecting the data itself, and so now you've got to layer all of this stuff in place. And if you do it well, because granted, this is a long-term initiative that you got to go at, and it takes a lot of, as you were talking about micro-segmentation, it takes a lot of micro-movements in order to get there in an environment, because it is just, there's so many pieces and puzzle facets to the puzzle. So I really like the way you describe that.
Well, I mean,
Zero trust in a larger identity access management plan. For most organizations, a great time to do that is when you're moving more assets to the cloud. It's usually more cost effective and to design that cloud environment, whether that is your EMR, EHR in the cloud or adopting, you know, Azure 365 services. You know, that's really a key place to look at the zero trust, to look at where you're going to have, you know, the connectivity and the controls between those systems. And it's a space that's radically changing. So, you know, Cisco came out now with what they're calling passwordless, you know, authentication with Duo. I think that was announced 3 days ago. We've seen Vice reporting in the last month that shows where SMS hijacking is, essentially as a service these days. You know, for $16, they used a service and took over a cell phone. So it's not a static, you know, where you do this once and you hand out a token or you hand out an app. You really have to adopt this as a secure by design principle every time you're looking at another integration, where you're putting your data and where you're enabling access.
Right, and in that regard, I'm a big cloud buff also. In fact, I was at your website. One of the things that really intrigued me most was the Adafio Cloud. In my view, I try to be vendor neutral, but I think Microsoft Azure is a much better job with Zero Trust than MFA in terms of the security protocols and tools available to, like, a healthcare organization than does the AWS. But that's just my 2 cents worth.
I would agree with that assessment.
Interesting too is, and you know, we're learning and clients are learning and we're asking questions about, you know, MFA of electronic medical record vendors, and it is a bit of a puzzle to work because, you know, not all MFA solutions work with all other applications. So, you know, then you kind of zero in on, well, you go back to data governance, defining, you know, where your PHI is. And so it really is a very detailed process to, you know, to have these conversations and then to make a plan and prioritize, you know, those most crucial applications and where that data lives.
Yeah, that's very
spot on there.
The flexibility you have to have both to handle premises workforce, work from home, you know, whether you're doing it with secure cards and badge taps or tokens or biometrics, and applying different levels of those protections and monitoring based on the data that they're talking to and their roles. There's a lot of design elements to consider when you're looking at identity and access management there.
Yeah, excellent. One thing I want to keep our audience in mind too is that when it comes to the Zero Trust framework, it's something that just can't be haphazardly thrown together all at once. It takes a very phased in, a very planned approach. And it's something that's a very dynamic process. You just can't do it once and then expect it's going to keep in tune with the threat landscape. You have to keep it updated constantly with the new threats that are coming out. But now, are providers, such as health IT developers of certified health IT and health information networks, are they prepared for the information blocking rule and these regulations that go into effect on April 5th? I was not aware of this. Could you kind of give more background into that?
Yes. So the Office of the National Coordinator, we've been, you know, talking about ONC a lot. So the ONC Cures Act final rule supports, I'm just going to read a few things from their website because honestly, this is a very confusing, frustrating, and really just there's a general sense of anxiety in the healthcare community right now about this information blocking rule, which is part of, again, the ONC Cure final rule that is going into effect with a compliance date of next week. And overall, I just want to say, the work that I've been doing in healthcare IT for a number of years, I'm in full support of what this rule is designed to do, because it really is designed to put the patient in the center of their healthcare and be the owner of their health record. Right now, providers, health IT developers like electronic medical record companies, policymakers, and insurance companies really kind of hold a lot of different keys to this data. And the intent of this rule is good, because essentially what it's asking healthcare providers and healthcare IT developers to do is require that patients can electronically access all of their electronic health information, whether it's structured or unstructured, at no cost. And so for most of the listeners, that is a patient portal. So both of us have gone, to the doctor or been in the hospital and said, oh, you can go out and look at your records online. Well, some of the issues that we're seeing with that in the healthcare community is you have very limited data sets, and you're not getting to see all of your health information. They're only pushing out a few pieces of the information, so it's really just not that valuable. So I would say in general, overall, the healthcare community is not prepared for this. We're seeing in just the last 2 weeks that a lot of the electronic medical record vendors have put together webinars, which we're in the process of getting on, listening and learning what type of changes that they need to make to their system, because essentially they have to be in compliance with this rule as well, meaning that they cannot lock down health information or put in general or global settings that would not provide patients timely access to their electronic health information if they want it or if they request it. And therein lies a lot of the different definitions and confusions and clarifications and trying to figure out, the best way to implement proper workflows that, don't push things out to patients that they may not be, ready to see or ready to look at, like a lab result or a test result that, may be something that's bad and they haven't had a chance to talk to that provider yet. So I would say in general, again, overall, and it was just reconfirmed for me this week that at this ONC national meeting that we were on, we heard from, top EMR vendors. Cerner was one of the EMR vendors that was on a panel, and heard from really just a lot of big national organizations that they're all trying to get information out to their customers, to their clients, users of their applications and electronic medical records, to say, hey, guys, this is what we've got to do, to be in compliance with this rule. And you as our customer and helping house this data need to understand what we've got to do to be in compliance. And you also need to understand, what you need to do, which we've got a few tips down here and an additional question that we'll talk about. Kenzie, do you think I missed anything that's just really, really important? Or just kind of an overview on the information blocking rule in the ONC?
No, I think you covered everything pretty much as far as, what it is, are they prepared, and kind of where all these EMRs are at and being prepared for it. I think there are some things we can talk about, related to policies and updates and things. But as far as overall where we're at with that, where the EMRs are and what it is, I think that covers it.
Yeah. There, I do want to say one more thing, Robbie. There is, there were some comments made at that ONC national meeting this week, which was virtual, by the way, so which I was glad, because then we were able to attend for free. But, there's confusion, and there's even, there's some misalignment, or at least some perceived misalignment of HIPAA and the information blocking rule. And the response that the ONC gave to that was they're really not in conflict. They really are synergetic, if you will, and they released just some new FAQs about some of that this week as well. So, but there is, again, just a misunderstanding, if you will, and then, again, just, you know, not sure where that alignment is.
Okay. Do you have any place on your website, like a blog or a white paper or just even a web page where people who are listening to the show can go to get more information about this information blocking rule?
So I do want to point everyone today to healthit.gov information blocking. So www.healthit.gov and then // information blocking. We have not produced anything to date. We are thinking about that, but right now that's something that really we want to do with potentially long-term with a legal firm, because again, there is so much information in this information blocking rule. It has to be really developed and looked at by our clients with their compliance teams, their medical record teams, their clinicians, so their doctors, their nurses, and then their executive teams and legal counsel. So there's a lot that's going on here, and really staying plugged in with their electronic medical record vendors and just understanding what changes that they are making to stay in compliance and meet these compliance states as well. It's going to be crucial that everybody really just works together to figure this out, because, this is something that, again, because it's compliance and policy-driven, legal counsel has to be included on this. And hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. Now, how quickly should healthcare providers educate their staff about these information blocking rules and what they should do to come into compliance with them? Is there strong? Go ahead.
Yeah, they should certainly be doing that now. And again, that's one of the things that we heard again on this national meeting this week is, you know, it's not that providers or, you know, healthcare organizations don't want to be in compliance with this rule, because they do. They absolutely do. The frustration and some of the stress is, you know, we just came off of a year of COVID. One of the other things that was mentioned on the panel this week was, you know, a lot of staff in the last year was laid off if they weren't direct patient care. And so those are the type positions, that would take care of these types of things, right? So if you weren't, you know, just day in, day out patient facing, then those were the types of staff that, you know, healthcare organizations just unfortunately had to lay off because, you know, they weren't able to maintain all of that staff. So, it's not that, again, we've put it on the back burner, or healthcare organizations have put it on the back burner, but we just really are coming out of this public health emergency. And also, we just completed quality reporting. You still had to report quality data from 2020, and those reporting windows are closed this week. So anyway, that's why we are really talking about this hot and heavy now, asking everybody to go out to healthit.gov and review that page. There are fact sheets out there. There are previous webinars. And again, I mentioned the new FAQs that they have just put out on this. And there's also a link where patients can actually go and report information blocking as well.
Okay. Excellent. Now, are there any changes that need to be made to the policies and requests from patients in order to get access to their test results or lab results?
Kinsey, I think you kind of touched on that one just a little bit. Do you think there's anything else that's really crucial that we cover today on that? From my perspective, I'll let her think about that for a minute, but I think, again, this just requires that you go back and review, you know, what your previous policy stated, and you make updates, you know, to your organization. And then again, I know we've already talked about this, but just to hammer it home, it's once you do make edits and updates to those policies, then your workforce that is in, you know, has those responsibilities for getting that information to the patients, they need to know and understand and be in compliance with your organizational policies. Because a lot of the times, that's really where the disconnect is.
Yeah, I'll just say definitely there will be some changes to more specifically the privacy policy of the organization, because we're talking about a difference in timeline as far as the patient's right of access. And, of course, this is more specific to the electronic health information. But so there definitely will be some policy updates that will need to be made. What I would like to state is just going back to, you know, what are those things that healthcare organizations need to be doing? And one of the things that I wanted to emphasize is having a compliance steering committee, and as part of that committee, having the right people on the committee. You need to have representation from, you know, your IT, CIO, compliance officer, privacy and security, and have the proper representation so that your policies and your procedures, both privacy and security, are reflecting exactly what is going on in the organization, and then also having that committee meeting on a regular basis, having a regular standing agenda to cover, you know, items in, you know, HIPAA regulation updates that need to be looked at, and reviewing these policies on a regular basis as part of that committee. And then also that gives you that opportunity to focus on risk management and that risk management plan. Reporting on any incidents or potential violations or breaches that have occurred, so that you have that synergy and that communication across all or departments. And because HIPAA touches every area of healthcare, so your covered entity, you have everywhere from your, you know, again, your privacy, your security, your IT, compliance, billing, you know, boots on the ground. So, you know, your clinic staff, it really touches everyone, and you need to be able to have a committee that has that representation to ensure that your policies and your procedures are reflective of, you know, what's going on, technology changes versus regulatory changes, processes within the organization, and a true reflection of that. So that would be one of the four things that I would say that healthcare organizations need to be focusing on. And to piggyback off of that is documentation. So as we're talking about policies and updates for the information blocking rule, there's also documentation not only of your policies and your procedures, but ensuring that you have proper documentation. Going back and talking about the risk management and your SRA, and if there were to be a breach, you know, having that audit folder to have all of your documentation to make that process just a little bit easier, and tracking all of your applicable documentation from your training to policies and policy updates, potential incidents, your MIPS and your SRAs. And just ensuring that you have that process for that efficient documentation.
Well, and absolutely. I want to say a word about that committee as well. You know, that is an operational, you know, it is critical to operational execution and documentation. That has got a great cultural impact as well. You know, as Kinsey was talking about compliance touching so many different areas. You know, security is going to touch so many different areas. Making sure you have members from different parts of your organization, finance or clinical staff, providers, nursing, you know, a variety of members on that is an opportunity to increase the culture of the entire organization, because they're learning about, you know, more about the compliance and security. They are becoming advocates when they, you know, go back into those departments. And they're bringing insight diversity to your organization. They're going to see opportunities to improve. They're going to see risks that you may not see if you are just looking at security or compliance or finance. And so over time, that becomes a great feedback channel and a way to increase the culture of security and compliance throughout the organization.
Okay. Excellent. Now, what about the exceptions to the rules, and do those need to be documented? Are there any exceptions to these information blocking rules?
Yes. So as part of the CARES Act in Section 4004, they did lay out eight categories of what they term reasonable and necessary activities that do not constitute information blocking, provided certain conditions are met. Okay. So what I want the listeners to hear, though, is that just because, let's say, a practice meets one of these eight conditions of an exception, that doesn't mean that that would automatically constitute information blocking. So what I mean by that is practices do not have a guaranteed protection from civil monetary penalties or appropriate what they term disincentives. And these really do need to be evaluated and documented in a patient's medical record on a case-by-case basis. This is very important. On every, you know, EHR vendor webinar I've been on and every ONC webinar I've been on that is talking about this, everybody repeats this one thing over and over. There is alignment that this case-by-case basis documented in the patient's medical record, you know, is crucial if you're going to look at, you know, deciding that you're going to hold this information back, you know, for a certain set of time to a patient. And so these eight exceptions are divided into two classes. And the first one is an exceptions that involve not fulfilling requests to access, exchange, or use of electronic health information. And the second one is exceptions that involve procedures for fulfilling requests to access, exchange, or use of electronic health information. And I will say there's a really good graphic that, again, if they go, your listeners go out to healthit.gov information blocking, they can look at the graphic. And I really do like what they've done with this graphic because it shows all eight of these and how they're dividing out. So there are some privacy exceptions, some security exceptions, infeasibility exceptions, licensing and fees exceptions, which, again, a lot of this, like Kinsey was stating earlier, aligns with HIPAA. But the main thing that, again, I want listeners to hear is, you know, what we don't want to see organizations try to do is, well, let's just, you know, bulk everyone into a privacy exception or a security exception, because that's just not how this works. So anyway, yes, absolutely. These do need to be documented and well understood.
Okay, excellent. Now, as we come to closing part of our show here, just a couple of questions I want to ask. You know, the COVID-19, the remote workforce thing, that's evolved to a new field called telehealth, you know, and I had one probably a few months ago with my gastro an enterologist, you know, rather than meeting him face-to-face, it was all done on the phone. And I thought that was kind of weird. I mean, kind of weird at the time. But hey, does the doctor do any work with telehealth professionals also, or is it strictly you deal with brick-and-mortar offices? Or
Yes, we absolutely, we do support some clients that offer telehealth and are still offering telehealth, actually probably most of our healthcare clients. We don't currently support, you know, every one of our clients with healthcare consulting, so we may or may not know about every little thing that they're doing, but I can tell you at the very beginning of the pandemic last year, and this ties into HIPAA too, our team jointly together with the cyber experts and the healthcare consulting experts created a one-pager document around, you know, proper implementation of a secure telehealth solution. So, yes, we see that as being something that is really proven out to be something that patients want. And that as long as payers like Medicare, you know, Blue Cross, Qualtrics, all the major big players will continue to pay for it, patients are going to still continue to want it.
Okay. Another issue that I want to kind of bring up with all of you is Internet of Things. You know, that's where basically everything's connected. in both the virtual and the physical world, and their smart homes, smart cars, blah, blah, blah. But in the medical and healthcare industry, now we're seeing a lot of medical devices also being connected with one another. And in fact, now there is a huge risk for patients that have implanted medical devices that a cyber attacker can literally now, like, tap into that device and do some kind of really horrible damage, like if someone has a pacemaker, do something to it so the heart can, I mean, I hate to say this, but have the heart stop beating and the patient drop dead. Now, I'm mortified when I think about the potential of that. What are your thoughts on that?
Many and varied. It's troubling to say the least. We see many of our clients kind of struggling with some of the same ideas and same thoughts. We talked a bit about it earlier in this, this idea of the zero trust model and micro-segmentation. Those are the types of ideas and responses I think that we're going to see begin to be effective. If I could take us back to the NIST model for just a second, one of the earliest things you do is you identify all of the devices that you're concerned about, that you're responsible for, that are inside of your purview, right? It all starts with a good inventory of what am I trying to protect?
Well, and when you bring those devices on board as part of that asset management and supply chain risk management, how are those updates done to those devices? How are they monitored? What access do they need? So, knowing what you have, knowing what they should be doing, knowing where things should be communicating, so that you know how to monitor and how to segment those. So you really cannot disconnect IoT from asset management and, secure by design principles. The fundamentals here still apply and will take care of a vast majority of the risk. And there are certainly an increase of risk because of the criticality of those. But the basic approach is how to get started on how you bring these in, how you manage them, how you monitor, and how you keep track of what you have in place.
Okay, excellent. Now, my last question here for you is artificial intelligence. That's one of the biggest buzzwords now being bandied about here in cybersecurity. In fact, I just got a book that came out on AI. It's a very misunderstood concept, I think. Has Adafio or any of you personally with your clients dealt with AI tools for, like, medical devices or, like, reporting or doing assessments or anything like that?
Well, we're certainly seeing AI be embedded in services, whether that's, security intelligence, threat intelligence services, reporting platforms, those sort of elements. So by and large, I see AI or machine learning or GANs, all of that kind of falls up underneath AI, is being added on to existing services. I've not encountered large kind of standalone deployments of healthcare organizations using standing up AI instances to on their own. But we certainly see that as a factor, and you need to know what that means, right? This is a term, I agree, you said it's misunderstood. It's not only misunderstood, sometimes I think in sales it's intentionally misunderstood. Hey, go buy this product and we got machine learning on the back end, or we have artificial intelligence on the back end. You need to know what is the role of that. Where did those algorithms come from? What is its purpose? What are the controls around it? It's a very, very powerful tool. I'll say it plainly, but, in the security industry, sometimes it seems like vendors are saying, oh, yeah, it's AI takes care of all of this. Well, how do you know? What sort of insights do you have to ensure that it's being taken care of? So just because it says AI doesn't mean, okay, that's great. You ask some more questions about what its role is and how it's controlled and governed.
For sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Keith makes some great points there. You know, that I'll simply put it, you know, most everything has its place, but there is no replacement for critical thought.
Right. Okay. Well, as we know now, go ahead.
I was just going to add, in a lot of the electronic medical record solutions and applications, you know, they're building in different AI components help out, you know, reporting on data and also just making suggestions to clinicians on how to take care of patients. How much the clinicians really buy into that, I'm not totally bought into it as well. But definitely it's something that's going on in the electronic medical record.
Now, SC is saying AI is, the idea is to mimic the thought process of the human brain. We'll never even come close to 0.1% of that. We may just understand how the neurons and dendrites all work together, but we will never understand the human brain. It's probably one of the most complex things. In fact, asking, like, where does space end? You know, space end? Does it start anywhere else? You know? It's something that we'll never, ever understand as a human race. But those are just my two thoughts, 2 cents on that. But anyway, as we wrap up our – go ahead.
I know. I was just agreeing. I was thinking about clinical decision support rules. But anyway.
No, I mean, see, my dad was a professor of biology at Purdue, actually. He was a neuroscientist involved in spinal cord regeneration research, and – he was trying to figure out a way how to help paraplegics walk again if they've been injured in car accident. He was on some kind of breakthrough, from what I understand, about using amniotic fluid in a different way or something. But he unfortunately died of a heart attack, like right before all that could have come out. But that's how I kind of got my insight in the human brain. And kind of, he told me that we will never, it's like the cosmos, we'll never really ever fully understand it. But that's a topic for today. But anyway, as we wrap up our show, cybersecurity industry and healthcare is going to be a hot topic this year, next year. Do you guys have any final parting thoughts for our audience? And if not, what's the best way for people to get a hold of you in case they want to engage your services, they have questions? What's the best way for them to contact you?
So I will I'll cover something that I was supposed to cover at the beginning. I'd encourage your listeners and everyone to go out to, you know, our website at www.adafio.com. If you go to adafio.com/about, there's a really good introduction to an Adafio's core values and how we approach business. You know, I'd say to get a hold of us, the website has some areas to reach out to us for sales, and you can also, you know, call our main number and get into the lines there. And Adafio is spelled E-D-A-F-I-O.
Okay. Excellent. Any other final parting thoughts?
The only other one I would say, again, is just thank you, Ravi, for having us. Really enjoyed the time. Yes. And we do have that telehealth solutions in response to COVID-19. One pager that's out there on our blog as well. So Jeremy just gave you guys the website information. So if you go hit our website, we've got tons of blogs out there, and that's in the blog section of the website. Search telehealth /blog.
If you can send me a copy of that, I'd be more than happy to put that on my blog site as well too. So.
Okay. Yes. Absolutely. We'll do.
Okay. All right. Well, we thank you for the time this afternoon. I know it's Easter, so everybody have a happy Easter. And I really want to have you guys on for another future podcast. As I said, this is a topic that's going to be very much hot button coming into Q2, Q3 for the rest of the year and going into next year as well, too. So please let me know in time. I'd like to have you all on board again, okay?
Awesome.
Good.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robbie.
Have a great year as well, and your listeners.
Thank you so much. Have a good weekend.
Bye-bye.